y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s-loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of sexual assault, domestic violence, child abuse, child death, and drug use. Listener discretion is advised.
In 2008, 39-year-old Melissa Lucio became the first Hispanic woman sentenced to death in the state of Texas. She's been tried and convicted of capital murder in the death of her 2-year-old daughter, Mariah Alvarez. On February 17, 2007, first responders were called to Melissa's home to find Mariah in cardiac arrest. Despite resuscitation efforts, Mariah was pronounced dead at the hospital. She was found covered in bruises, with the cause of death ultimately determined to be from a significant head injury. Melissa had no documented history of abuse, but before investigators had even left her home that night, they'd formed their opinion of what happened, despite Melissa's explanation. Since her sentencing, people across the world have been lobbying on Melissa's behalf, petitioning for a stay of execution and hopefully a full exoneration. Was Melissa wrongly convicted and sentenced to death, or was she responsible for the death of her youngest child?
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
All right. We know that this has to do with the death of a child. So that means that some of you are going to peace out on this episode, and we totally understand that.
Absolutely.
It is, I think, an episode that contains some important things to discuss. But again, you know, if it's not your jam, we'll catch you on the next one. And we do want to give a couple Hey Girl thank yous to Alicia, Marie Collins, Emily, and Kelsey Panza for requesting this.
Yes, and thank you to Madison for writing it up.
Thank you, thank you. All right, well, shall we just dive right on into it?
I think we will.
Okay. Melissa Elizabeth Lucio was born in Lubbock, Texas on June 18th, 1969 to single mother Esperanza. Sorry. Yeah. So country. Esperanza.
And also this is, it has a lot of Hispanic names. So sorry.
Not my strong suit. Yeah. Esperanza Correa Trevino. Melissa had two sisters, Sonia and Diane, and at least one brother named Renee. Is that Renee? Okay.
Yeah.
Diane said that Melissa was always a loving person. She just had a rough life and a difficult childhood. Diane and Melissa shared a bedroom as girls, and Diane would often have to stand up for Melissa when their sister Sonia teased her. Diane said that she and Melissa never had arguments. They never got into fights with each other. She described her sister as quiet but well-liked. Though Diane remembered the good memories she had with her sister, they did say that Melissa's childhood was an absolute nightmare. So, her mother, Esperanza, said that she recalled going into the kitchen once, and Melissa, who was a child, was crying. And Melissa tells her mother, "Your boyfriend has been sexually abusing me." And she tells her mother this. The reaction that she got for this was not what you would hope. So her mother was outraged. She told Melissa that it wasn't true. And you don't ever speak of that again. You don't say stuff like that. It's not true. It couldn't be true. You know, leave it alone, basically.
Well, and she also said, you know, I didn't believe her because Melissa was just so young when she said it. But it doesn't matter what age you are.
Right. Well, because I believe she was 6 at this time. Like, she was really young. If my son came to me and said, I don't know the exact words that she used. I'm sure she wasn't like, "Mom, he's sexually abusing me." I'm sure she said something to the effect of, "He's touching me," or I don't know what she said. But if my son told me that something like that was happening, even at 5 or 6 years old, where would he get that information? We don't sit and talk about that, you know? We talk about that people shouldn't, you know, that nobody should touch you if you don't want to be touched, and also, you know, in your private areas and like that kind of stuff. But I don't, like, you know what I mean? Like, that information has to come from somewhere, or that idea, because otherwise how would she know about it?
Yeah, so I think that you should absolutely take it seriously and believe absolutely. Your children.
Every single time, yeah. Now, we do know, like, the McMartin preschool case and trial, that it's not always actually true. But there are things that you can do. She probably could have taken Melissa to a doctor, like to her pediatrician, and asked them to look for signs. She could have, and I get it, like, some of this is, you know, financially supported and things like that, but maybe she could have gotten her into a counselor or something like that, but, or even asked him. I mean, maybe he would have just said, yeah. I mean, I don't know.
At the very least, she could have had a constructive conversation with Melissa and said, "I am so sorry that this is happening to you. I believe you. If you feel comfortable, tell me more. Or if you don't feel comfortable being around him, we will," you know, like.
Yes.
That's the least you can do.
Yeah. Take one step. But instead, she was just like, "That's just not true.
And we're not talking about this ever again." Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, and Melissa claimed that she'd been being sexually abused beginning at the age of 6, and then it just didn't stop. So now we've got a situation where it should have never happened in the first place, but at the very least, it could have been stopped. But now it just goes on her entire childhood. Mm-hmm. It's just awful. One of Melissa's dreams, even at a young age, was to have a family of her own. She wanted to have children. And she ends up getting married at the age of 16. And, you know, it could have been that she wanted to get out of that household. I wouldn't blame her for that. She certainly didn't feel super loved and supported
in her home. And her mom gave permission for her to get married at such a young age. And I don't know if that was her mom's way of being like, hey, I fucked up, and so this can get you out of here, or I don't know, but, you know. So if she was trying to get out of an abusive household, she got out of one and went into another, basically.
Out of the fire into the frying pan.
Exactly. So,
or vice versa, whatever.
Yeah. Her husband was a drug dealer. He was both physically and emotionally abusive, which, of course, would continue to affect Melissa's mental and physical health. And she ended up falling into her husband's habit, and she became addicted to cocaine. By the age of 24, she had 5 children. She got married at 16. That's 8 years. That's a lot. Despite the environment she was living in and the abuse she continued to suffer through, being a mother gave Melissa a purpose. When Melissa was just 26 years old, her husband abandoned her and their children. Left one day, didn't come back. Perfect. She moved in with a man named Robert Alvarez and then ended up giving birth to 7 more children and unfortunately had 2 miscarriages along the way. According to the kids, Robert, just like Melissa's first husband, was also abusive toward her. Sonia, Melissa's.
Are you British all of a sudden?
I think I am. I think I just... Excuse me, I'm British now.
You can't just be British all of a sudden.
I know. I wish.
Not Madonna.
What a great accent. Oh, yeah, that's true. Sonia, Melissa's other sister, later said that she believed Melissa felt like she was the black sheep of the family. So she lived in rundown apartments with 1 or 2 bedrooms. We're talking about 14 people living in these apartments.
Mm-hmm.
She had very little belongings. They would sometimes have to take like furniture that they saw on the side of the road that somebody was getting rid of, you know, like that kind of stuff. And despite all of these hardships, she never complained about her life. And she also didn't ask for help from her family, which is like admirable on one hand, but also like ask for help. You know, you don't have to
go it alone.
Yeah. Yeah. And during this time, Melissa's drug addiction continued, and 3 of her children were born with cocaine in their systems. Why did we not get her help then? Like, the medical community could have stepped in at that point.
Well, it's not like they didn't know.
Right. Like, people don't stay addicted to drugs because they like it. It's just not like, I'm sure she would have quit if she felt like she could, but it changes so many, chemical processes in your brain and things like that. Like, if you know that these children are being born with it in their system, like you said, it's not like they didn't know. Like, now you know for sure. Get her some help. I mean, goodness. Melissa's brother remembered that sometimes she would lock herself in the bathroom until she was sober, not wanting her children to see her like that. He said that his sister's demons took over everything that she had. Though she struggled with substance abuse, one of her daughters, Daniela, later said that she always made sure the kids ate, that they were bathed, that they were clothed, all of those things. The Texas Department of Family and Protective Services was alerted of the domestic violence going on in the Lucio Alvarez home by the children, as well as a school principal who actually saw Robert punch Melissa in the face. And again, we've talked about this before. He did that in a public area.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly where it happened, but the principal saw it.
Yes. Yeah.
What is he doing behind closed doors in their home?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's awful. There are also reports that the DFPS was informed of claims of sexual abuse of the younger children by Robert, and also by one of the older sons. Charges were filed against her son, but nothing was done regarding the domestic abuse. While Melissa's dream of being a mother had come true, things were rarely ever easy for the family. They actually moved 26 times between 1994 and 2007 because they were routinely unable to pay rent. And there were even time periods where the family lived in a public park. People would see the children sleeping on benches and things out in the park, which is just so sad. In 2004, Melissa's seven youngest children were removed by DFPS due to negligence. The report cited that the removal was deriving primarily from poverty, including a lack of supervision, an unclean home environment, inadequate food, lack of electricity or water, and homelessness. No reports of abuse, though, had ever been filed against Melissa, except when her children tested positive for cocaine at birth, but she was never reported, documented, any of those things as being physically abusive to her children. And I think that's important to note. At the time that the children were removed, the youngest of the children was Mariah Alvarez, at this time just 2 weeks old. The children were placed into foster care. During this time, it was found that, quote, Mariah had a physical disability that left her prone to stumbling and falling. So one of her feet was turned more inwards and it kind of left her with a different gait. Melissa reportedly did everything she could to try to get her children back. She went to parenting classes, counseling. She went to substance abuse classes. She cherished the weekly supervised visits that she had with them.
And I think that it is also super important, in my opinion, to note that Melissa, while obviously having a lot of these hardships that we have talked about, like life was not easy for her or for her kids. I understand that completely. But she loved those kids. They were the most important thing to her.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, cocaine's an expensive habit. I've heard.
They call it rich man's drug.
Yeah.
Or something.
But also I'm trying to think of what case this may have been. I'm pretty sure we talked about another case where, yes. Hang on. The documentary was Why Did You Kill Me?
Oh, sure.
And that, I don't remember the mom's name in that. It's been a while since I've seen it. But she talked about becoming addicted to meth. And she said for her, she had several children too. And she said for her, it gave her the energy she needed to do all the things for everybody. And I mean, that's 12 kids. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a hard time keeping up with two and remembering all the stuff for two. And, you know, it's like, that's a lot of kids. That's a lot of mental energy, physical energy, emotional energy that you've got to give out. And she was also trying to support them financially. She didn't really have a lot of help. Her husband slash now this
abuser.
Other. Yeah. Like all of her partners have been abusive. I venture to guess they weren't super helpful with the kids.
I would say not. I mean, maybe that's a generalization, but I don't think they were.
Yeah.
And I would also guess that they probably weren't helping as much financially because her first husband just abandoned them, you know? Like,
yeah, it's not like they were getting child support checks, I'm sure.
Right.
So I don't know. It's understandable in all the trauma that she's had in her past, it's understandable that she tries cocaine and she's like, okay, now I can keep up with everything. Or it's numbing the things that I'm dealing with. You know, I mean, there's just so many reasons, but nobody ever begins that path hoping that they will then have trouble taking care of their children.
Right.
Like nobody ever goes into it thinking that and hoping that that's going to happen. But,
right.
And they did have trouble paying their bills. I mean, they had to move several times because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Several is an understatement, but I don't know. It's just, I just feel so sad for her, you know, because she did. She loved those children more than anything. It had nothing to do with any lack of her love for her kids. It, you know, just something completely separate. In January of 2006, Robert was incarcerated again. Feeling safer than she had in a while, Melissa was able to attend rehab and find the support that she needed to get sober. She was able to get a job as a home health provider. When Robert was released from prison in October of 2006, Melissa reportedly tried to leave him, but he threatened to kill her if she did. Fortunately, the family was able to move into a three-bedroom apartment, with all of their children being returned to them in late November. So obviously, she has made a lot of progress because the Department of Child Services gave her the kids back.
Yeah.
And that's a big deal, right? It wasn't long, though, before bills went unpaid and Melissa was served with an eviction notice. So they found another apartment, but it wasn't ready to be moved into yet. So while the landlord was completing repairs, they moved into a separate apartment, which was a second floor apartment.
On February 17th, 2007, two-year-old Mariah was reportedly watching television with her siblings, and the family had spent the past 2 days moving out of their temporary two-story or second-story apartment, and they were going to move into what they hoped was a more permanent space in that first-floor apartment that was now ready. One of Mariah's older brothers recalled that Melissa was cleaning, she was folding laundry, and he noticed Melissa was really tired. Mariah was really tired. She'd been sleeping way more than normal over the past 2 days, and she also had some congestion and a loss of appetite. Melissa considered taking Mariah to the doctor, but the whole family was just so exhausted from the move, so she was like, well, I'll wait until tomorrow. Eventually, Mariah closed her eyes and went to sleep, but she never woke back up. Shortly after Mariah fell asleep, it was noticed that she wasn't breathing. The family panicked and immediately called 911. First responders arrived on scene to find Mariah in cardiac arrest. They transported her to a nearby hospital, doing everything they could to resuscitate Mariah, but upon arrival at the hospital, she was pronounced dead. No one could understand why a seemingly healthy toddler had gone down for a nap and just never woken up. Melissa told paramedics on scene that Mariah had fallen down a flight of stairs a few days earlier. The paramedic reported being suspicious of Melissa's story because the apartment they were in at that time was just a one-story apartment. It had maybe 3 or 4 stairs out front.
Yeah, it's just so, because like, what is the, I don't know, they just moved into this one. So it's like, she's talking about the stairs from the other apartment and they're looking around being like, yeah, right. Like, falling down 3 stairs is not going to do this. You pretty much just slip and like slide on your butt, basically.
Or, I mean, like scrape your knee or something, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So one of the responders later said that Melissa wasn't acting like a mother whose daughter was dead. She wasn't crying. She wasn't showing much emotion. And they were immediately suspicious that Melissa knew more about Mariah's death than she was telling them. Their suspicions were relayed to the police, and when Mariah was brought into the hospital, she was found to have significant bruising across her body. This backed up the growing suspicion that Mariah's death wasn't caused by a fall, that she was the victim of physical abuse.
You guys know how we feel about using affect or demeanor as evidence.
Mm-hmm.
It don't go. You just never know.
I will say this, though. There have been occasions I go back and forth between like shows that I like to fall asleep to. I don't think that I'm alone in my principles with this. It's sometimes Snapped. It's sometimes Evil Lives Here. Lately, it's been Dateline. Can't stop, won't stop. Need to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was watching a Dateline and it's called Twisted. And this woman, she's recalling a situation where she said that there were 2 intruders who broke into her home and her kids are in the house. Then anyway, she ends up shooting one of the intruders. The other intruder, she claims GTFO'd, but she shoots this one. And she's telling the story to, it wasn't Keith Morrison. I cannot remember which guy it was. It wasn't Mankey with Hank either. But anyway.
And maybe it had to have been Dennis then.
I guess so. Yes. Dark brown hair and it's like to the side kind of.
Is he older?
A little bit, yeah.
Oh, or was it the I don't remember the other guy. Anyway, that part doesn't matter.
Neither here nor there. But she's making all of the faces as if she's crying. she's doing the like, and I was so scared. And like, she's, you know, she, and no tears, not one single tear. She did not have to wipe her eyes. She didn't have to do anything. She's, it was almost felt like to me personally, she was trying to make herself cry, but it wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, I was like, I don't believe her, because it's like she's trying so hard to produce one tear and she can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did she end up, did you finish it? No.
I fell asleep.
No. So we don't know if she did it or not, or if she knew what she was doing. Yeah, I think there's definitely times, you know, we've talked about this, but like with the Betsy Faria murder, they said that Russ was overly emotional and therefore they didn't believe him. They thought it was an act. If you're not emotional enough, it's, I mean, it's just one of those things where it's like, you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You can have that. You can say, all right, I'm noticing that. I'm picking up on it. But then you need evidence to go along with it. So
to
it's
back
like,
it up. Yeah,
exactly. Because I never remember. I think it was the murder of Justin Michael, where the guy, I think the guy's name who ended up doing it was like David Moffat or something like that. But it was a mixtape that we did. I saw it on a Dateline episode and I was like, oh. So he breaks into this couple's house. They're about to get married. He shoots the guy in the head as he lays there sleeping. The fiance, the girl, is laying right next to him, but she's not injured at all, right? This person comes in the house, shoots him, leaves. So the police are like, obviously she set it up, right? Like, why would somebody come in and kill him and not her? Like, obviously she set it up. And his mom happened to be staying with them that weekend. She had come in to visit. So she's in the home when this happens. Her son has just been murdered. Do you know neither one of them shed a tear during anything, really any part of it at first? And it turns out they absolutely had nothing to do with it, that this was the fiance's ex-boyfriend who was pissed that she was going to marry somebody else. So he killed him.
Well, and the
they were in shock
about, yes, about grief and the realization of certain news or whatever. The, you know, you can have a range of emotions. Some people break down and cannot stop crying. Some people are in shock and some people are in denial. Some people are, you know,
well,
I cannot.
Yeah, some people get angry. Right.
Yes.
You know, they're, like you said, there's stages of grief and you experience all of them and not necessarily in the same order. You know, like, I don't know. Yeah. It's just, I understand taking note of it. I understand paying attention to it. But then it needs to have evidence to back it up. And it's just so frustrating that there are investigators that will use that as evidence when that's not what it is. It's just another factor that you can look at, but it's not evidence.
No. And they, oh gosh, with, I'm sorry to bring it up, but Darlie Routier, like, or Routier, however you want to say her last name, but they use that shit in court. Mm-hmm. Look, she's, the mom didn't even cry.
Mm-hmm.
She's a mother.
Right.
And she didn't even cry. She doesn't care about her kids.
Exactly. And that's something with women, especially if you are a mother and your child has died, you are judged so much more harshly, I think, than a man would be. And that is a really big factor and something that really sways juries. Like you said, look at this. She's the mother. And she, what kind of mother wouldn't cry about her daughter dying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Melissa, they don't think she's acting appropriately. This is a mother. So obviously she doesn't love her kids, right? Like that's all there is to it. She's violated the mother role, the female role that she's supposed to be in. So forget her. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. So just a few hours after Mariah was pronounced dead, Melissa was brought in for questioning with police. Melissa told investigators that Mariah had fallen down the stairs, but it was at their old two-story apartment. That's why It didn't make sense at first because I'm not talking about the 3 or 4 stairs. I'm talking about a big flight of stairs. And this was a flight of stairs that led from the outdoor front porch of the apartment to the ground. It was made of wood. It was really uneven. It had pieces missing. And there were 14 stairs leading down to the ground.
This is a big flight of stairs.
Yes, it is.
And like, it's rickety looking.
Yes, it is. I wouldn't even feel comfortable with it holding anybody's weight, like even my children, you know, like it's really bad.
I don't
bad.
Think I'd feel comfortable walking down if I was holding groceries.
Oh,
going
for
down
sure.
those steps or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. especially a toddler, just letting them go by themselves, which mm-hmm. Melissa did not do. She didn't. Anyway, it makes sense for a fall to have occurred looking at these stairs.
Exactly. Because if you think about it, like, you know, we've got stairs that go from our bottom story to our top story or whatever. I think there's about the same amount, 14, 16 stairs, something like that. Those are not rickety. They're very sturdy.
And they're not steep. They're not incline steep. Is not.
Yeah. But especially if one of my kids fell from all the way at the top of the stairs to the bottom, I mean, that's something I've been very scared of since we moved into this house. They're older now, so they can get up and down the stairs a lot easier, but they weren't allowed to go up and down the stairs at all by themselves until they were like 4 or 5. Probably not that old, but you know what I mean? When they were 2,
when you're 15,
that terrified me. Exactly.
You can do the stairs by yourself, but not yeah. until then, though.
And you have to hold on, too. And I have to
and
watch
hold my
you.
Hand.
Exactly. Yeah, yes. I mean, it is really scary. So if you can see pictures of these stairs online, or if you watch the Hulu documentary, The State of Texas versus Melissa Lucio, they also show the stairs there. So you can look at those and be like, that would be devastating if a 2-year-old fell from those.
If an adult,
very obvious.
I'm yeah. telling you, they were not safe stairs.
Exactly. Melissa told detectives that on February 15th, so that was 2 days prior, she was getting things cleaned up and ready to move into their new apartment. After breakfast, several of the children went outside to play while the others got ready for school. Mariah and Alexandra, an older sister, stayed inside with Melissa. And it wasn't long before Melissa noticed that her 2-year-old was gone. She ran outside and saw Mariah laying at the bottom of the wooden stairs. She figured that she must have opened up the unlocked front screen door. Melissa said that Mariah was awake, but she was crying. She didn't know whether Mariah had fallen down the entire flight of stairs or had she maybe gotten down several steps and then fallen, like, no idea. When she picked her daughter up, she noticed that she was bleeding from her lip, but didn't notice any other injuries. And this was not the first time that Mariah had fallen and gotten hurt. Though she'd been prescribed orthopedic shoes for her feet, she still fell often. One time she fell at daycare and reportedly lost consciousness and suffered a traumatic brain injury. Melissa was worried that Mariah had fallen, but she didn't see any reason that she needed emergent care. I mean, if you look at your kid and you think, okay, well, there's you got maybe a little scrape on your lip, like, whew, that was lucky. That could have been much worse, right?
And she did not see the fall. So she has nothing to go off of. I think if she had seen the fall, possibly, mm-hmm. now alleged, I don't know, but if she had seen the fall and she saw that it came from the very top to the very bottom, she might have even if with just the bloody lip, she might have been like, that was a bad fall. We need to take you in. But she didn't see it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I go back and forth with this, you know. I think she should have taken her.
Sure.
I understand that they were in the process of moving and all those things. I also understand that the doctor is really expensive. And sometimes you need to make those decisions. Like, I can only go if it's bad enough to go.
How severe is this?
Yeah. You don't want to go. I mean, I took one of them. I think it was Ben. Took him to the doctor one time because I was fucking positive he had an ear infection. He'd been pulling at his ear. So he was young. He couldn't talk yet, I don't think. And he was doing all the things that, okay, he's probably got an ear infection, right? Yeah. So I bring him to the doctor. I see the pediatrician. And she's like, oh, yeah, he's got a little tooth coming through now. And apparently when babies are teething, they can't really tell the difference between what is pain in their ear and what is pain in their mouth. And so they will sometimes, it'll kind of mimic some of the symptoms of an ear infection. Sure. And they will get snotty and like all that kind of stuff. So yeah. I paid $150 for my doctor to tell me that he was cutting a tooth, you know? And I know that sometimes you don't want to go to the doctor and make a big deal out of nothing, you know, like, is it really that bad? Like, I don't, you know, might feel embarrassed or whatever. It's such a large flight of stairs. I mean, obviously she should have taken her, but
I don't have a dog in this fight because I don't think that it's fair for me as not a mother. You know what I mean? It's like that saying, like, I was a much better parent before I had kids. Like, I don't want to parent anybody else's kids. I think that you are entitled to give your opinion because you have kids. I would hope that if it was me in that situation, I would have, but I'm not, I don't want to get mm-hmm. it. You know what I mean? I don't feel like it's fair for me to do it.
And I'm saying, obviously, she should have taken her because she died. So I'm just saying, you know, maybe they could have caught it, but I mean, also, if they took her to the doctor and they looked at her physically and said, she outwardly, she looks okay. I don't know that a doctor would have necessarily ordered an MRI or something.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, we don't know what would have happened, you know. And again, there are other factors that goes into it. Financial is always something that is a factor. And if you go to the doctor, you're spending money. Like, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. But anyway, and it didn't look, like we said, outwardly, it didn't look like she needed to go to the doctor.
Sure.
But interrogators just did not believe what Melissa was telling them. Over the next several hours, five investigators took turns questioning Melissa. Photos of Mariah's extensive injuries were brought into the room to show Melissa, and they demanded to know what happened to cause these. What happened? Just tell us what happened. Tell us what happened. I can't help you if you don't tell me what happened. The photo showed Mariah's lifeless body covered in black and blue bruising. It's been asserted that during the 5 to 6 hour interrogation, Melissa was not given anything to eat or drink. She was not even given access to the bathroom. I also heard that she was pregnant with twins during this time. She's not slept. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. She's not given any food or drink, and she's pregnant and she can't go to the bathroom. I mean, in one of Melissa's eventual appeals, it's written, quote, Ms. Lucio asserted her innocence more than 100 times, but police refused to accept any response that was not an admission of guilt, suggesting to Ms. Lucio that the interrogation would not stop unless she told them what they wanted to hear.
This is reminiscent of a lot of different cases, but it's really giving me season one of The Devil You Know.
Oh.
Where
yes.
She said, I did not do it. I did not do it. I did not do it. I didn't do it. It was an accident. This is what happened. This is how it happened. This is how it happened. And they were like, And she finally was like, okay.
Yep. Exactly. I mean, that happens. Like, you know, and I know sometimes they'll interrogate somebody. And
oh, excuse me, season
like,
two. It's season two of Devil You Know. I'm so sorry.
Oh, you're right. It was season two. Okay,
season one was Pazuzu. Season two was Sherry Schreiner.
You're right. Yeah. So I know that sometimes they'll interrogate somebody and they will deny it at first. You know, no, I didn't do it. No, I wasn't there, whatever. But a confession is no good unless the confession matches the evidence that you have.
Yeah.
They have to go together. But there are so many investigators that are just like, well, she said she did it.
And it's not uncommon. It's wild to me, but it's not uncommon for people to give false confessions. And I'm not saying wild because, like, in this situation, I can understand how it happens. You are pushed. Mm-hmm. You finally break. You know, I get it. I can understand how this could happen. What I'm saying, which is wild, is there are people who go up to the police station and they're like, it was me, I did it. And they're like, you don't go here.
You don't even go here. Yeah. Like what?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. There are people who would just insert themselves into cases for no reason whatsoever. Yeah. Other than attention or whatever. Yeah.
Right.
At one point, the investigators even brought a baby doll into the room and asked Melissa to show them how she disciplined Mariah. And I will say, this part of the interrogation is the opening scene in the Hulu documentary. And so the investigator is like, okay, you know, did you spank her? And she's like, well, yeah, I spanked her. And he's like, show me how you did it. So they lay the baby doll down because she's got the bruises all over her back, right? So they lay the baby doll down on her belly. And they're asking Melissa to show how hard you spanked her. And so she like hits the doll and he's like, well, that's not hard enough. And she'd hit the doll again. Well, that's not hard enough. And he'd go back and forth with her. And then he would, at one point, the detective slaps like himself on the knee or something like that. And he's like, see, that's not hard enough to make a mark or something like that.
Yeah.
And she says, well, that's because you're doing it to yourself. Like, I don't know. Watching that first scene.
And you have no context at all. Like, I didn't have any context.
No context. Yeah. When she says that, I didn't know about it before this. I was like, why the fuck am I supposed to feel sorry for this woman? She beat her child to death. Like, that's what this part looks like. If you have only this.
Absolutely. Because at first, I was like, I'm getting ready to get fired up. Like, and you do get fired up, but then it twists on its head. But yeah, mm-hmm. I was like, what are we doing here?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, okay, well, if she was hitting this child as hard as she is hitting this baby doll, and this is a 2-year-old, I mean, you don't hit anybody this hard, but you know what I mean? Like, it looks bad. It looks really bad. And then eventually she says, well, I guess I did it. And after she says that, case closed, Melissa murdered her daughter. We're not going to look into anything else. We're not going to consider any other possibilities, right?
Slam dunk for the detectives or investigators, right?
Exactly. The initial autopsy on Mariah was performed by Dr. Norma Jean Farley, a forensic pathologist. She recalled Mariah's case as the worst case of child abuse that she'd ever seen. There were bruises found everywhere, on her head, under her hair, her neck, chest, bottom, back, and extremities. She also noted what she believed to be a bite mark on Mariah's body.
I'm not laughing about what we're talking about necessarily, you know what I mean? But when I hear the word bite mark,
yeah,
I can't help but do all of the eye roll emojis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're a patron, you know how we feel about bite mark analysis from the Innocence Files. Because there's the first 2 or 3 episodes even? 3 episodes, I think, have to do with bite mark cases.
Uh-huh.
And they are a crock of shit. I mean, yeah. So now this woman says, oh, and there's also a bite mark on her body. And the consensus with a bite mark is this had to have been done on purpose, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's what that alludes to. Dr. Farley also recorded that Mariah had a broken arm that had not been treated, which she attributed to prior abuse. That is concerning to me. Because the notes that she wrote about the broken arm was that it would have had to happen from between 2 to 7 weeks before her death. Like it was that level of healing process or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That does concern me. Okay. Some reports also say that Mariah had hair missing that appeared to have been torn out at the root. Dr. Farley ruled that Mariah had died from a severe head injury. The blood that had accumulated in the skull was what ended up killing her. She also said that Mariah's injuries, she said, quote, must have been caused by intentional force within 24 hours of her death. So she tightens that up to 24 hours. We know that she fell 48 hours prior.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting rid of any possibility that the fall could have attributed to her death.
I am not a forensic pathologist, obviously. I'm not an investigator. I am not a professional in this field, but I can see, we don't see the autopsy photos or anything. They don't put them on the screen for us to see. You see them kind of when they're being shown to Melissa. You can see a little bit. I could understand not knowing everything that I know at the end. I could see seeing those bruises and all that kind of stuff and thinking, of course she was beaten. Of course she was.
Yeah, it does. I agree. It does. It looks really bad. Even if she had fallen down the stairs, it looks really bad.
And all over her little body.
Yes.
Yes.
And it has to, once you learn, which we'll talk about, all of the scientific reasons why that can happen because of what happened to her when she fell, if you're not presented with that information, then you would make that conclusion, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
The state of Texas charged Melissa with capital murder of Mariah, asserting that they had plenty of evidence that pointed to Melissa having knowingly caused her daughter's death. Her trial began on June 30th, 2008. One of the biggest and first pieces of evidence presented for the prosecution was Melissa's quote-unquote confession. During the interrogation by investigators, Melissa had vaguely admitted that she had caused Mariah's death. This was only admitted after hours of her denying that she'd intentionally hurt her daughter. The court viewed about 3 minutes of that hours-long interrogation video, and the jury was not present. How and why? And so they determined that Melissa clearly understood her rights and that her confession was not coerced.
How do we determine in a 3-minute clip of a 6-hour interrogation that she clearly understood her rights?
Right.
And I'm not saying anything negative about Melissa. How many times have we heard Miranda rights? You know, that's something that in high school you've heard. You have the right to remain silent. You have the blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't know them all, but I've heard it plenty of times.
You have the right to be
for your lawyer
to be a president.
To be president. Exactly. That's a standard right. So, like, in that 3-minute clip, how do they look at that and say she completely understands all of these rights? She didn't, because she told them 100 times or more that she did not kill her daughter. And she could have ended that interview at any time that she wanted. She could have demanded that she have a lawyer present for it. So she clearly didn't understand her rights, because she would have invoked them, but she didn't. So you've got 3 minutes of a 6-hour interrogation. And look, Melissa was not well educated. She wasn't. You can be well educated and not know that you have the right to ask for an attorney. Before, you don't have to answer questions that a police officer asks you. I didn't know that till we started this podcast.
Absolutely.
You know, if I was in an interrogation or interview with police, I would think I'm going to get in trouble if I don't answer the questions.
And what the taboo or stigma is a lot of times, which I've seen it still to this day on in so many cases and on so many TV shows, they're like, well, he lawyered up. What does that tell you?
Must be guilty. I have said that in this podcast before. I know I have.
That's because you're closed-minded.
Well, and I'm stupid. I mean, it's just, you know, like, I don't remember specifically what case, but I promise you, if you go back and listen to some of our early episodes, I'm positive that I have said at one time or another, because I did not know, oh, well, that guy got a lawyer, so, you know, obviously, he's guilty. Yeah.
I know I did it too. Absolutely. Because you don't know what you don't know.
Exactly. And you grow up hearing that your whole life, or, you know, you grow up hearing, well, this person was found guilty, therefore they did it. No, they were found guilty. You know,
I don't know, up until we started doing this and got more into it. Yeah. And we started talking about wrongful convictions. I thought, if they're convicted, then they're guilty, obviously. But also, if they're a person of interest, why would they look at somebody that didn't do it?
Uh-huh. They wouldn't question somebody who didn't have something to do with it. They wouldn't prosecute somebody who didn't do it. The police wouldn't arrest somebody if they didn't do it.
There has to be evidence, because there's no way that they would do this if there wasn't evidence.
Right. And furthermore, all of those things. Like, and these are just biases that many, many Americans have.
Yeah.
Because of TV shows that we watch, CSI, and, you know, all those things. Like, a lot of the American people, at the very least, have shaped what they know about the justice system around a TV show that shows that if DNA evidence comes in while this man is on trial, the lawyer can walk in and be like, no, no, this shows that it was him right there. And they're like, oh, well, you go home and we'll arrest you then. That's not how it works. So like, these are still fictional shows that are dramatized to make them more interesting. And they definitely don't follow 100% the actual procedure or whatever. But you've got all that. And then you also have the bias that an innocent person would not admit to doing something they did not do. And I have said that before. I grew up feeling that way.
I'll tell you, one of the first times that that was called into question for myself, and that was making a murderer.
Yeah.
That was huge for me because I was like mind blown.
Absolutely.
I did not know that this was possible.
Yeah. And look at Amanda Knox.
It's scary, dude. Mm-hmm. It is so scary.
She admitted to murdering Meredith Kercher when we know for sure that she did not. We know for sure that she did not. But, and she was well educated.
Yeah.
But she was scared. And she didn't know her rights.
The fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The fear, for sure. And like we said, I mean, we've talked about it till we're blue in the face now that we know. And I'm sure there are so many more that we haven't even thought about. But there, it would be really, really amazing if, at the very least, this podcast could help people understand what we didn't know, but now we do understand or know better about, like, what just... make better jurors, make better...
Absolutely.
Even just to be questioned, you have rights. You do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to go through this. And I will say... So, okay, let me finish this real quick.
Yes. Okay, sorry.
So, Melissa's defense attorney, Peter Gilman, who we are going to talk a lot about, never attempted to suppress her statement, nor did he present any information to show that she'd been under duress at the time of the confession. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Sing it again.
Absolutely. Absolutely nothing. What was the point of you? You have no point, sir.
No, not even a little bit. And we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but I thought it was very interesting. So if you watch the State of Texas versus Melissa Lucio on Hulu, they bring up a lot. There are a couple different... I think an assistant prosecutor or I can't remember who it was, but they're like, she was offered a plea deal.
Yes.
She was offered a plea deal. She could have had 30 years and she could have gotten out, but she didn't want to do that. Well, it got me thinking because I understand, if not from personal experience, obviously, but I understand that if you know that you didn't do something, you're not going to take a plea deal. I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do, right? But then it got me thinking, if you take a plea deal, can you even appeal it? No, you may not.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. You can request to have it reversed to like not guilty. But I don't know if that's
if you take a plea deal, then you are pleading guilty.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
And I'm sure it's state by state, but I never thought about it that way. Like if you're sentenced, you can appeal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And you can try to get a new trial. And yeah. But if you take a plea deal, there is no trial.
So
it's not like you can request a new trial. Yeah, exactly. That's true. And I mean, we've said it so many times before, plea deals only help guilty people. If you are not guilty and you take a plea deal.
Yeah.
Then she's writing her own sentence for 30 years for a crime that she did not commit. And there may not even be a crime here.
Absolutely. And one would hope that, I mean, look at, why can't I remember anybody's names? The football player, wrongfully convicted.
Greg Kelly.
You have hope. In the justice system. I didn't do it. I know I didn't do it. Mm-hmm. And they're going to see that.
Yeah, because there's not any evidence that's going to convict me.
Yeah.
Oh, but I wasn't counting on the fact that they're going to use my affect directly after I learned that my daughter had died. Mm-hmm. And I was in shock. And she may have been high. I don't know. I don't know if she was still sober at that point.
Right.
Just there are other things that could have affected her demeanor. But mm-hmm. that... you know, you're not counting on that being as evidence that proves you guilty of murder.
No, absolutely not. And so let's say you do take the plea deal. Yeah, that's a lot better than life in prison or death penalty or whatever. But you hope that when you go to trial, people are going to see it. They're going to know. They're going to know that I didn't do this. They're going to know, right? Mm-hmm. You would hope. Mm-hmm. It's a gamble, but sometimes it doesn't pay off. But I can completely understand not wanting to do the plea deal if you're innocent, mm-hmm. because you're like, no, it's not. That is, this cannot be happening.
Right. I also wonder, too, like, I would love to see, I don't even know if there's like a statistic of this at all, but we know that false confessions happen, right? People sure. will, under duress, confess to something that they did not do. But then those people typically turn around and they don't accept plea deals and they don't plead guilty. I know that plenty of guilty people plead not guilty, but I'm just wondering, like, wouldn't that typically show the prosecutor something like, okay, I offered her this deal and she's not taking it. It's either intense arrogance, you know, O.J. Simpson. Or
his worked out though.
Exactly. Or maybe she really didn't do it, because if you did it and you know the death penalty is on the table, you'd be crazy not to take the 30-year sentence.
Exactly. So to me, that shows that the innocence.
You, right. Like, yeah. Wouldn't that kind of make you stop and think? Like, because Melissa Lucio is not an O.J. Simpson. She doesn't have a star defense team that she has, you know, unlimited funds to pay for. And he is incredibly arrogant and had a history of getting out of trouble. Oh, and had a history of violence towards basically everybody. Like, that's not what you have right here. So it's pretty easy to tell if it's arrogance or not arrogance, you know?
Well, and what she had was a bullshit attorney.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what she had. Absolutely. Who did not do his job at all. Not in fact, he helped the prosecution, in my opinion. So
he absolutely did. And we'll talk about that next episode, because there's some stuff there too. There's some shady shit in this case.
Oh, yes. But that will be on part two.
Yeah. You know, sometimes we get into these and we just don't know what's going to happen. So we're surprising you. We surprised ourselves with a two-parter.
We really did.
We didn't know it was going to happen. So yeah, this is now a two-parter. So you will get, again, if you're a patron, you get part two immediately. If you're not a patron, ain't no thing. You'll get it free next week with ads. If you're a patron, though, you get it now ad-free. And all the episodes ad-free. So, you know, something to think about.
Yeah, just let it roll around in the old noodle.
Yes. And then I also wanted to say, I mean, I don't, you know, some people don't like to get ahead of themselves when they're listening to something. But you can go to, if you want to kind of look into, because the Innocence Project has gotten on to this case too, you can go to, I'm sorry, I had the website somewhere and now I don't know where it went. It is, I believe it's savemelissa.org. Savemelissa.org. So you can get information about where her case stands and like all that kind of stuff. I mean, we've already told you we're going to talk about wrongful conviction. So if you want information between now and either in the next 5 minutes or next week, you can go there.
Yes. But thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. We love you. And we'll catch you next episode.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, you guys. It's shout out time.
It's the shout out.
Oh my gosh. We love you guys so much. Also, I wish Apple subscriptions let us do this. We can't know who subscribes. So, you know, a thank you to all the Apple subscription people. We wish we knew your names. I'm so sorry. These are our newest patrons on Patreon. Because they do let us know your names. So we want to, and we're also going to fuck your name up. I think you already know that's coming. Just to let you know. Thank you to Maddie.
Victoria Rice.
Madison.
Amy Baumgartner.
Mm-hmm. Trisha Endinger.
Jenny Nicewarner.
Holly Heckerman.
Lauren Starbrook.
Kyla.
Atalia Aitchison.
Hannah Fowler.
Stephanie Crawford.
Madison Murchie,
Alana Medina,
Emma Ryle,
Misty Dolovich,
Emily Ludeman,
Gabby Borchers,
Carissa Kay,
Lex Lewis Simeon,
Tiffany Rebecca,
D,
Kim Warduck,
McKinley Hinkle,
Ashley,
Nicole Phillips,
Allison Feldmeyer,
Autumn,
Samantha Main,
Stephanie Bonilla,
Aaron,
Hannah Conroy,
Teresa Graves,
Erica Wilson,
Hannah Bell,
Rayan Mega?
Yeah, something like that.
Sorry.
Let us know. We're sure it's beautiful. We just probably messed it up.
Oh, yeah.
Mindy Trust,
Angelique Sandoval,
Zoe Spencer,
Hannah Trishel,
Caitlin McDonald,
Jasmine Willis,
Chrissy Cornell,
Dana,
Lindsay Stacy,
Leanne,
Tawny Green,
Elise Hernandez, it could be Alize, Elise Hernandez,
Ashley Kridlich,
and Alyssa Padilla.
Yay! Thank you guys so much. Please forgive us. We know not what we do if we fucked your name all up. And we just love you guys so much. You make this being our job possible, and we cannot thank you enough.
Yes, thank you, thank you, thank you. We love you. Bye.
Bye.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation. Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.